Welcome to Sleepy Hollow.
Hello, and welcome to Sleepy Hollow podcast, your podcast all about the Fox TV show Sleepy Hollow. Before we begin, just like to say that this episode is going to be focusing on episodes 6 and 7 of series 2. We apologise that it is so late, but we've been cursed, I think, shall we say, by illness and technology and pretty much everything. So how are you this week, Abby?
Right now I'm really good. Okay. Right now, I'm a lot better than I was a couple days ago, so I can appreciate that. I'm very, very good. How about you?
I'm also quite good. This week has been a lot less stressful than last week. Trying to teach sick is not a task I wish on anybody. Apparently, all my colleagues in the science department, whenever I came in on Monday of last week, which is when I was at my sickest, because I should have taken a sick day, but even as a teacher, taking a sick day is probably more work than just coming in and fighting through it. Because you have to think, right, I have to phone in and I have to tell the sub-teacher what I want them to do. And that's just a pain on the ass. So I just came in. But they all said, it was like, you look like a zombie. Do you want to go home? But yeah, I'm much, much better. So, so again, we're very, very sorry that this is very late. If you're listening to this around the sort of 13th, 14th of November, we will also be dealing with episode 8, but we're going to be doing that on Saturday, because trying to squish 3 episodes into 1 podcast is going to be very difficult and long. And we don't want to do that. So we will be doing an episode 8 in the coming next couple of days. So without further ado, let's start with episode 6. I vividly remember the opening to this episode, which was the yoga opening.
Yes, with Crane and his hair down. And Abby doing, what is it? She's like holding her body up. That was amazing. I don't even know what the pose is called, but it was great.
I did a little bit of yoga once upon a time. I don't know what that pose is. That's quite advanced, that sort of standing up against the wall. But I love the sort of the cold opening. Sleepy Hollow is quite good at that, where it starts off and you immediately think, oh my god, what's happening? And it and it turns out to be something completely different, usually quite innocent.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is very good at that, now that you mention it.
It's done it a couple of times now. Although, I don't think we have a cold opening to rival episode 1 of this series. Which was insane.
Yeah. Agreed.
Okay. So, this episode we were introduced to August Corbin's son, Joe Corbin. And the first thing I have written down here is props to the casting department. He actually really looked like him.
He did. I think everybody was like, wow. Like, there were a couple, like, snide comments regarding other characters and casting choices. But I think it was just because they did such a wonderful job with this one. You were just like, oh my god, are we sure that isn't his actual son? Like, yeah, it was good. They did a really nice job.
Yeah, I remember vividly looking up and was like, do these actors have the same surname? No, they don't. What is this witchcraft? Yeah, what did you think of Joe?
I really thought it was, first of all, it was really great to have him because it was giving Abby some backstory. You know, we got a little bit of what it was like for her, mm-hmm. you know, growing up with Corbin and not being the only person in the house and sort of like Abby being the golden child again. Oddly, you know, we talk about what Abby's done and what and where she was, but it seems that Corbin, at least for Joe, had some favoritism, and there's a little tension between Jenny, and so it seems to be like a theme slash trait of Abby's that there's this greatness in her, and it sort of literally like soaks up everyone and everything around her. So to be able to see sort of a dynamic that I hadn't seen, that I didn't really know was there, emerge, and it emerged through this character I think he was written very well, and I think he was very interesting. I really enjoyed what he brought to the table in terms of the monster and Abby's backstory and sort of bringing Corbin back for us. And I wish I had told you this before. I wish he'd stayed a little bit.
Even if it was just to get more sort of backstory, because they had Abby and August had such a wonderful relationship that it's such a shame that he left the series so quickly. It was good to see the
I think it's also a shame that we don't get to see more of it.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's clear that there could be more of it. We're just not getting more of it. And, like, Joe was, like, our chance to do that. It was really great having him there.
But I suppose because, you know, he's still around.
He could come back.
We can keep our fingers crossed. Because that was a... We can see the purpose of this character. Not to make a jibe at any other character, Holly, but...
Oh, no, Holly has a purpose. He most certainly has a purpose. It's just that nobody
a valid purpose. Okay.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. Okay, valid, yes. A valid purpose. Oh my god, I feel so bad. I'm starting to feel really bad for this actor. Like, because I know that about 60% of the fandom is like, what are you doing here? It's terrible. But it's true.
I don't blame them, though. Yeah. So
no, I don't. I don't either.
So yeah, we get introduced to Joe, and we get that sort of animosity between Abby and Joe, because Joe feels that Abby was favored growing up. Although I did like the really nice story about him when she was babysitting, about the sort of he was going to save her and he was Spider-Man, which is just really, really sweet. I can't remember if that was later in the episode, but I think that was Abby talking to Crane. But it was very sweet.
Yeah, it was. Very, very sweet.
We cut to then Henry and Frank back in Tarrytown, and we learned that in the hospital with Frank is the guy who caused Maisie to lose her ability to walk. And Henry is sort of taunting him and pushing Frank to kill this guy. And I just got so cross. I got so, so cross. What do you think about that sort of torment that Henry is putting Frank through?
Well, first, explain to me why you got so cross. Explain that a little bit. I want to hear that.
Sorry?
Just explain, like, how or why is what I mean. Why you got cross.
Oh, because in a good way. Like, I think that's where Henry's character as a villain sort of shines. It makes me really hate him, rather than the other side that they're trying to push, which is his redemption. I think Henry shines as a villain when he's doing the bad, manipulative, evil stuff, which makes me just want to throw things at the TV, because Frank is... Frank's my baby. I don't want to see him hurt or murdering people, because that's going to just push him over the edge and push him to be what Henry wants him to be, which is this soldier that he's making him into. But yeah, it made me angry in a good way. Like, oh, Henry's being evil and vindictive.
Oh, you evil Henry.
This chick.
I think that fans have developed, including myself, a certain level of feeling very protective of Frank. And I think it's because he's probably, at least per a lot of what happened in season one, we haven't got a lot of him in season two, but per what happened in season one of the show's biggest and best heroes. And so we don't like to see the good guys struggling. And again, this was one of those things where I was like, oh, backstory. So we're actually gonna talk about this thing, you know, that happened to Frank. We're gonna discuss this and we're gonna get more info about it. I don't think I was perhaps as entertained by Henry's evil, not in the sense that he's not good at it. But I really, it was hard watching Frank do the push-pull thing. At the same time, it was really enjoyable because I legitimately feel like as a character in this moment, you know, when he's internally struggling with wanting to end the man who he feels essentially sort of in a way ended his daughter's life. Her life isn't over by any means. He still has her. She's still here. But Frank feels a level of responsibility because of how he responded to the situation. So he's in this moment, and there's this level of push-pull that feels very organic in the writing. And it's not like we haven't seen something like this before. It's just that it's so refreshing to see it. How do I put this? In a non-repetitive way. Like, I feel like having this in the episode, watching Henry taunt Frank, because while also, I mean, he's close, but he's maintaining distance. There's still a distance and disconnect between Frank and Henry that isn't necessarily there with other characters. And to sort of watch him lord over Frank and watch this hero struggle. Like it felt, I've said this, refreshing, organic. It felt relatable. I wanted to root for Frank, and I felt like if Frank slipped, unlike with other characters at this point, because of the repetitive nature of their development versus his non-repetitive nature, that I probably would not be as hard on him as I am on some of the other characters. I feel like Frank has done so much to be good and to stay on the right track and in the face of a lot of adversity. And it was really great to see him. Like I said, I would have understood if he slipped, but it was really great to see him not. To keep it together, you know, to remember what his task is and to remember who he is. I feel like we have heroes in the story that aren't doing that at all. And to see Frank stepping up and doing this over something that most people probably would have killed that man for, I thought it was fantastic. I thought that was really, really great writing.
Yeah, I just seeing him so strong, and yeah, I totally agree. If he can be strong in the face of really tempting sort of tempting stuff, for lack of a better word, then why can't other characters remember their one job?
My favorite part about this is that we are actively avoiding saying the names of the other characters that we're talking about. I think that's my favorite part about this. It's interesting. I don't know if it's because Frank ha I've been thinking about this. I've been wondering if it's because Frank isn't getting as much screen time as some of the other characters, so this doesn't feel repetitive because we're only getting like bits and pieces of him every now and then. But there's something about Frank's storyline that I've always felt was really, really natural, like very human, very real. And the way that Frank responds to things, the things that he's set up against, I feel more so in a world of supernatural beings and, like, horsemen and the apocalypse. I feel like his is so... it's, like, the most likely. Like, yes, he is trying not to become an agent of evil. But at the same time, he's struggling with something that a lot of people... in our real reality, in our real world, struggle with, you know, when your child, when somebody kills your child and you're, the murderer stands in front of you, how do you respond?
Yeah.
Do you become the thing that you most fear? Do you become the thing that took the thing that you love away from you, or do you rise above that? And it's just, it's fantastic. And it's really, like you mentioned, Henry, it's really fantastic to see him being what he's supposed to be.
Yeah.
You know, to fit into that actual mold. This is what he is. Can we stop pretending that he's anything but? And the relationship between Frank and Henry in their scenes allows them to be what they are. It allows them to be their molds. Yeah, which is why I think their scenes were probably some of my favorites of the episode.
Yeah. We then sort of get another parade of famous people to add to the list of people Ichabod knows. And this one is a name that I've heard, but I'm not really familiar with, which is Daniel Boone.
Okay, yeah. I've heard of Daniel Boone, and I know the raccoon thing. The raccoon,
yeah.
Which, by the way, was a fantastic comedic beat. That was... the writing and the acting for that comedic beat were like spot on. I love it. I don't really know much about Daniel Boone myself. I feel like he's in an era of American history that I don't care much about. Or a person. Maybe this is just my school, but we didn't focus a lot on him. So I don't really have much to add about him except for the hat thing. And they made a joke about that. So, like...
Well, as a non-American, even I knew about the hat thing. So, I think it was because I watched too many American cartoons growing up. But, yeah, I knew about the hat thing. So...
But I feel like a really bad American right now.
But it leads us very well into the... Because it's linked with... the Wendigo storyline, which is the resolution of Henry crushing that bone pipe that we saw a couple of weeks ago. Because I remember watching that and going, oh, what are you up to now? What are you doing now? And it's nice to see that seed planted in an earlier episode and resolved later on. Because I think it wasn't the last episode, it was more than one episode ago, which is nice. I like that sort of... I don't like when it goes directly from one episode into the other. I like the hints dropped throughout 2-3 episodes.
See, I'm the opposite. I feel like the show takes way too long to follow up on storylines.
Okay.
Like, I feel like it's like 4 weeks later, and I'm like, wait, do you remember that thing that happened? And then the episode is like, oh yeah, we remember. And I'm like, but I don't care about that now. There's other things to take care of. Like, you know, like, I mean, this, I didn't feel that... that I didn't feel as jarred by this shift as I have by others. But yeah, the bone, this was the follow-up to the weird, scary crushing of children's bones.
Yeah.
This show is getting really dark, by the way. I want to point that out. Like,
it is
uncomfortably dark sometimes. Uncomfortably dark. And didn't they mention that they were going to be a little darker this season? I thought they mentioned that.
In the beginning of
the season. Yeah, this is the follow-up for that. It was interesting to have the Wendigo. Or the Wendigo. I have no idea. Which people say it both ways, and I have no idea which one is the proper one. I think my favorite part about that being in the story was how they constructed the monster. Because I watch a lot of, like, horror stuff. And I've seen Supernatural and I've seen Grimm, and everybody's like, oh, Sleepy Hollow took it from them. And I was like, no, it didn't. This story has been around for like ages. There are tons of cultures that have this story. But to sort of see it in a way that I hadn't visually before, I've never seen the monster represented that way. And so it was kind of fun to watch it. And I also like, I feel like Sleepy Hollow's special effects are a little campy sometimes. They're like a little B movie. Like, and I like that sometimes. I like that it feels a little goofy and out of place and strange, because the nature of their story is ridiculous. So like the things that you see in it should sometimes be ridiculous. And I felt like the monster was very much that.
Yeah, I would agree. It was very sort of look up monster in the dictionary and there you have it.
Yeah. It felt very Narnia. I know that probably seems like a weird thing to connect it to, but there were animals in the Narnia movies that had like similar in terms of body build,
yeah,
structure, in terms of makeup. The makeup build was very similar, so I was like, oh, look at that Narnia creature.
Well, that makes it sound like it wasn't very scary, but I do think
it was. I know, but it eats people. It's a human that eats people. Yeah. So, in case you didn't know, that's super scary.
So eventually they find out that it's Joe that's this Wendigo. He's been cursed by Henry, and they bring him back to their sort of their base, and Jenny is tasked with going out and getting him some organs to eat so that he could be transformed back. And it just, one of my favourite lines of the episode is whenever she sort of does a double back after saying that she got the organs and goes, we should probably donate blood or something. Just her face whenever she said that line, Lindy's face.
Like, we should set things right, guys.
It was good. And it was nice to see Jenny back, because I don't remember her being much in the previous episode. I think the only thing she showed up in the previous episode was... Or was that two episodes ago? Where she, like...
Was that two episodes ago? Oh. Girl. Either way, it's painful.
Yeah. It's painful that I'm struggling to remember when Jenny's popping up.
And it's painful to acknowledge that the last time she did pop up, whenever it was just a Mac on a guy.
Yeah.
That was literally her episode significance. Like, it's not just that we can't remember what episode she was in. It, part of the reason we can't remember is because of what she was doing.
Yeah.
You know, and how significant is that to the larger story? And I want to believe, like... I want to believe that there is a justifiable reason that Jenny is not present in the story right now. Like, I want to believe that, but the reasoning that comes to mind is we have to figure out a way to integrate Holly. And so we're just gonna sit on these other storylines until it becomes pertinent to bring them back. And I really thought that the show was kind of, I don't know how you feel about this, you can share your thoughts, but I felt like the show was over this kind of sitting and not prioritizing one over the other. The first three episodes of the season did a really wonderful job of following through on everybody's storylines for the very large part. It was juggling screen time for people well, and I don't know what happened between then and now. It was only like three episodes, four episodes, but it's gone.
Yeah.
I mean, do you feel like there's an inconsistency? Does this feel odd to you? Or is that just something that, because I do, I like ensembles and I like when multiple storylines run at the same time. And I know that that can be a preference for people. Not everybody likes that. So how did you feel about that?
Well, I find myself, I've noticed in the last couple of episodes more than I have at the beginning of the series, every so often I'll touch the mouse pad and see how far the slider is along the bottom, like how far we are through the episode, because I'm like, well, surely we've been on this scene for far too long. I mean, what time is it? They feel like they're dragging out this bit. I want to cut to someone else and see what someone else is doing at this point.
Interesting. Yeah, I like that you are noting like how long and how much time they're spending on a specific scene or like a plot, because that's how I've been feeling too. Like, I'll get to the end of the episode and I'll be like, okay, so I didn't get this character, this character, this character, this character. They still have unresolved issues, but what did I get? And then when I ask myself what I got, it feels like filler.
Yeah.
And I'm like, but why? You know, I think this is what I was nervous about. Remember when we were going back and forth and I was like, I don't know if 18 episodes is a good idea. I don't think this is a good idea. And I'm starting to feel like it's really not a good idea. Because it's just, I don't think it's helping any of the characters. I think they're still doing a lot of the things in season one that they were struggling with in 13 episodes, and they have 18. They're still doing a lot of the same, they still have a lot of the same writing issues. So I'm sort of wondering, like, what's going on in the writer's room? I feel like there's going to be, like, a big surprise. Like, there has to be a big surprise. There has to be a reason for all of this. That we're holding off on people, and that characters are coming back, or they're only getting scenes to talk about organs, which was still a great scene.
Yeah.
Not going to lie. But I don't know. It feels weird. And it feels really weird to not have Jenny there. She was really built into the story.
Mm-hmm. It feels really unbalanced. It just feels off.
Like the end, like the second half of season one?
Yeah. I feel bad saying it. I mean, and I still love the show, but I'm not rushing home every Tuesday to download the episode as I was at the beginning of the season. I'm going, I'll watch it at some point today, but I'm not rushing in and turning on the laptop, and that's the first thing I did, which I was doing for episodes 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. And it's just sort of getting, and I don't want to feel this way. What are the writers doing, you silly, silly people?
That's it. Nobody wants to feel that way. Like, there are a lot of people really invested in these characters who love these characters. And they want to be excited every week. Like, we want to, like, clutch our hearts. And we want to cry. And we want to scream. And we want to laugh. And we want to be proud of the work that the show is doing. And there's a lot to be proud of. But it's not consistent. And that's really hard as a fan to sit here and go, this thing that I care about and this thing that I love and this thing that I really want to support is not exciting me anymore. It's almost like a loveless marriage. I feel like we're falling out of love and I'm like grasping at straws. Like, I'm trying to find ways to still love it because I want to. This cast is incredible and the premise is so great.
Maybe it's one big huge metaphor for Ichabod and Katrina. I don't think they're that clever though.
They're literally trying. Everything is about Ichabod and Katrina right now.
Oh.
And it's about, it's just so, okay, nope. Let's just keep going.
I'm sure we'll talk more about it later.
Bring that back in.
Okay, I have, although it's sort of on topic, the next thing I have written down is, Holly's still making Googoo eyes at Abby with no response from her. So I had for episode 6, there's still, I get that they're trying to push it because Holly is making Googoo eyes at her across rooms. However, Abby's not having any of it at this point, episode 6. She's not having any of it. She's just, yeah, whatever. What do you think? Do you think sort of this far along? Because I know we talked about episode 8 before we hit the record button briefly. But do you think she's interested at episode 6?
I think that a lot of what Abby is doing right now is quite reminiscent and consistent with the way Abby was written and developed in season 1. When you look at how she responded to Andy, when you look at the way she responded to Luke,
mm-hmm.
I think that what we see here is the character. When we get to 208, we'll talk about how that diverges and how I think that having Luke more involved in the picture would have helped me as an Abby fan better understand Abby's romantic development. I think people, when you look at the story, there's obviously there's an action plot, there's dramatic plots, there's romantic plots, but there's also individual plots, all of these plots, comedic plots, that run in characters' veins. Each of the characters have their own plots. Their backstory helps fill these out. It helps make them people. Why does this person respond this way? You're never going to get, you know, fans write meta. They'll write like 3-page long metas about one scene, and there's maybe just a look in the scene, but the look says a lot, a line says a lot. And what we're getting right now, yes, this is who Abby is. This is consistent. This is the girl that I know. But things start to happen, and they start to happen, and you go, well, this doesn't feel right. Because you've never seen it before in a place that you very easily could have and should have seen it. So yes, Abby not making Google eyes at Holly, while also simultaneously, yes, they're doing that push-pull thing. I don't know, are you getting that? I really felt like 206 was doing that push-pull thing.
I didn't get it, maybe not so much. Not in 6.
Okay. Maybe just because, like, I know what's coming.
Yeah.
Like, I'm sitting here actively going, oh, these are the building blocks to this sort of relationship. This is how you write it. This is how it's typically developed. So I'm looking at it going, oh, yeah, that's what it is. But it could not be there. A lot of people I know commented about it and were like, nah, it's not there. Abby's not going to do that. Nah.
Because I remember thinking, well, I can see that they're trying to make this a thing, but if they're making this a thing, then why isn't Abby more into it?
Okay. Because they're actually allowing time for it to develop. That's why. Because we've never actually seen Abby have any substantial time with a man develop outside of Crane. We didn't see it with Luke. We didn't see it with Andy. And we didn't see it with Corbin. And so it's here now. And we're like, oh, wait a minute. This should have, like, the entirety of Abby's relationship with Corbin was built in 2 episodes. That's it. It was built in 2 episodes. Andy's, her relationship with Andy was very strongly, solidly built within 2 to 3. Our understanding of their dynamics and their history was 2 to 3. Luke, I don't even know if I could constitute 1 episode. They had a scene together in 107 that constituted theirs. It feels weird to give Abby this much time outside of Crane to develop a relationship with a man.
Yeah. I can see. Like, yeah, it's growing organically, and because we're kind of not used to seeing that, it looks odd. It feels slow.
Yes, yes. Yes, well, normally it wouldn't be. Like, people would be like, oh yeah, it's building. Like, I love a slow burn. Like, slow burns are my fave. But that's essentially what this sort of looks like, except we've never seen Abby do that before. So we're like, huh? What?
Okay. So the moving away from Holly, quickly and swiftly before we get bogged on. we get introduced to this poison called the Jinkin, and I have to admit, it looks freaking terrifying with all the bugs and the scorpions and the spiders all stuck inside this weird super poison. Ugh. Not nice. And Henry sort of ambushes their lair and gets Joe to get the Jinkin for him, promising that he will uncurse him from being the Wendigo. But of course, he betrays Joe and forces him to, we think, become a Wendigo permanently. Yeah, so again, Henry doing what Henry does best, being an actual villain, an actual not redeemable villain.
Villain. Oh, such an important word or phrase, I should say. Not redeemable. yeah, and sometimes it's really hard with the show because we keep getting these new characters, and this is gonna happen with the show. You're gonna get new characters who are like, I'm gonna trust this guy because I don't have the backstory or history with him that you do. So anything that you tell me, just I don't know if I can trust it. And you're as a viewer going, are you serious? I said right now, he's bad. This is not gonna work out the way you want it to. So you're sort of sitting there pulling your hair, like, for real, man. But I also felt like, I don't know, more so than I have with other characters recently, when Henry turned on Joe, it hurt. Like, I was legitimately scared for this character. I don't know what it was about Joe. Like, I really, there are things that I really liked about him that he added, but I really wanted good for him. And like watching Henry sort of go after, by the way, this was in a very long time, this was sort of Henry going after somebody that Abby knew. I feel like Henry's always like, I'm so mad at my parents, but his job as a horseman isn't just to be bitter about his parents. He's supposed to take down the witnesses. And so that involves weakening and scaring and ruffling Abby. And Joe was the last thing of Corbin that she sort of had left. Last living, breathing thing. His blood. And to see her believe in that and cherish that and want to protect that, her themes of family. To see Abby not lording over or rolling her eyes at somebody because they're not listening or feeling frustrated, but genuinely caring about this guy with her heart and wanting the best for him and him listening and understanding was, even as he's, even with the potential of that he had to harm her. It was just nice to see those bonds. I love lovey bonds. The show can do lovey bonds so great. They did a really wonderful job with writing Jenny and Abby. And this was just felt sort of like a like another branch growing out of that, of the Abby that we know who struggles with family and struggles with getting close to people. She does form bonds. She does care deeply. And she does trust, even when the thing that's looking back at her is a monster. She has faith. For as much as we like to be like, Crane has faith. I think that, you know what? It's interesting. Now that I think about 105 and I think about Ichabod's growth and how much he uses faith, I think Ichabod has a lot of blind faith.
Yeah, I would agree.
Think that sometimes that's valuable and sometimes it's really dangerous. I think that Abby, for as much as we like to be like, well, Crane is the faith one, Abby has a lot of faith. She has a lot of it. She keeps coming back and supporting Crane over and over and over again, even though she's going against her gut. She's putting her faith in somebody. He's not just risking his own life, he's risking hers and the lives of people she cares about. She's going out on a limb. She's talking to her sister when her sister's pointing a gun directly at her head. She's looking at Joe as a giant monster and believing with all of her heart that they can bring him back, even when all the signs say no. So she's faithful. She's a soldier. And I feel like in all the right ways. And thank you, Henry, for allowing us to see that. Abby Mills cannot be broken. Nuh-uh.
Well, on that point, just which is one of the last things I have here, Ichabod gets this shaman skull to try and reverse the Wendigo, and it appears not to work. Do we think that Joe turning back was the skull just clicking into life, or do you think it had a lot to do with Abby? Because I'm beginning to see patterns throughout the series of just how powerful Abby's faith is really, like, it's manifesting itself. And it does it again in episode 8, which we'll probably talk about.
Here's the thing, I love that. I love the idea that Abby's faith and then her willpower and her strength and her love can save people. Like, this is so exciting. Like, if this is a superpower, holla. But the thing is, like, I can't tell you because the show doesn't want to spend any time actually talking about and exploring witness powers. Like, I don't know what to consider a power and what not to consider a power. We still really haven't got any answers about Abby seeing people in 109.
Yeah.
You know? I feel like there's another show that I watched, I feel like I've talked about it before, called The Secret Circle, where it was, like, based off of, like, these... Do you remember that show?
I was part of the Save the Secret Circle hashtag, trying to get them to save it. I loved that show.
I ran that campaign.
Oh, God, it was...
So, the show sort of... Oh, my God, that is hilarious. we've been together way longer than we ever realized.
We have.
So, you sort of see this pitch of these witches who are supposed to have elemental powers. Each one of them is designated to have some sort of control over a different element. Which is really exciting, because, you know, like, when you think about The Last Airbender, or you think about this sort of stuff, the ability to fight, the ability to have balance and unity, and who's stronger in one position than the other. Like, that's sort of fun stuff that people want to see. And Sleepy Hollow sort of went there. And, like, The Secret Circle, Sleepy Hollow stopped going there. Like, it dropped the ball. I still have yet to quite understand why Ichabod is chosen.
Yeah.
You know, other than he was conveniently at every single... But the thing was, he was conveniently at every single moment, and a key important moment in early American history, because he was supposedly the witness. You know? But why? Why was he chosen? What is all this stuff going on with Abby? You know, I think that theme of faith in Abby, I think it's fantastic. I think it's wonderful. Let's see it. 105... And that moment between her and Ichabod, that moment for her in church, it was moving. It was powerful. It was transcendent. But is the show trying to create metaphorical links? I don't know. It's not. If it is, it's not doing a very good job of it. I don't mean to say that harshly or meanly,
yeah,
or even to be a joke. I mean, like, listen, I could meta on being human for days, because there was so much attention and detail paid to the specific themes that were attached to each and every character. I can't say that Sleepy Hollow was doing that. Frank was, like, the one character that we had that with. I mean, outside of Abby. I think that's why so many people like Frank. Because consistently he's written so well. Please, can you do that? I would love to see that. I would love for us to touch on that. I think it would be wonderful.
I just think the writers could take a page from High School Musical. They just need to get their head in the game. Sorry.
Wow.
Sorry.
I literally just thought about the dribbling scene on the first one. And then the one where he runs across the golf course.
Oh, God. Okay.
So they do need to get ahead of the game, though. That's true.
Get your head in the game, City Hall Riders. We'll probably talk more about it in episode 7. Because episode 7, which we're going to go on to now. Oh, before we go, just important fact that needs to be stated. Abby now knows that Frank has signed his soul over to Henry. They know.
Wait, this was 206 was when. Okay. 206 was when Frank called them, right? Yeah.
And he was like.
Okay. Can we take a second to talk about this?
Yeah.
Because I feel like, I don't know, man. I feel like Frank himself is not going to be his downfall. I think the lack of attention that's being paid to him by the witnesses will be.
Yeah. Because he called them.
I feel like he doesn't trust them. And I feel like he's right in that.
Yeah.
Like, it's a legitimately justified response that you are stuck in this. It's very reminiscent of what Jenny feels about Abby, you know, and why Abby had to get her out of jail again. Why it had to happen quickly. You can't have people fighting and dying for you. Without you acknowledging their work. I mean, this is like basic job and manager skills, like 101. Do you think that, okay, so I guess my question is this, because it feels like a building block. Do you think that the show is doing this intentionally to create tension down the line between Frank and the witnesses, or do you think this is just them dropping the ball in terms of balancing screen time?
I want to say that they are forward-thinking enough to be doing this intentionally, but from our past experiences, I think it's unfortunately more likely to be them dropping the ball. Like, I want to have faith. I want to have faith, and but there's only so many times I can be let down before I...
I literally feel like the audience is now experiencing, I think they're living vicariously through Abby.
Yeah.
I feel like in the show testing each of these characters' faith, they're testing viewers' faith in the show, too. Like, literally. Like, do we feel comfortable enough to say that the writers know what they're doing? Or, I mean, there were times that I think in season one that they were very smart about what they were doing. Other times, I think they left a lot of plot holes.
Yeah.
I
think the next hashtag needs to be Sleepy Hollow viewers deserve better.
Yeah. Oh, that's right. We're going into episode 7, so we're going
to... Yeah, so...
We're going to talk about that.
Let's move on to episode 7, which I am titling as Katrina's Uterus is a Plot Point. I don't like this episode, and I think that's the general reaction from absolutely everyone. And to the point where I have written very little, I was just sort of watching it going, what is this crap that they're trying to feed me right now?
Okay, so I saw that an Examiner writer had done an early review of it, and I was reading it. And I don't usually like to do that. I don't like to watch the show with other fans. Not because I don't want to be with other fans, but because I don't like my viewing experience to sort of be influenced by other people.
Yeah.
And that's part of why I really like screeners, is that I can sort of form my opinions and have my ideas and set them in motion. And then I can sort of take in what everybody else is saying and feeling and sort of flesh out from their responses. You know, reevaluate what's happening in an episode. And I remember reading this and going, I don't know how well this episode is going to go over, but I'm going to give it a shot. And then I remember screening it and getting about 30 minutes in and being like, I don't even know if I want to finish this. I was talking to a friend, a fellow writer. I reviewed a show last year called Twisted, and I had a very similar response during the show's second half. The second half of the season, where it was literally like it moved from like confusion to anger to bitterness to apathy. And like, once you get to apathy, you're in a really bad place with your viewers.
Yeah.
Because at least when they're angry at you, it means they still care. Do you know? Like, they're like, oh my God, fix the story. I want to believe in the story. I want to care about the story. But I got 30 minutes in and I was like, am I coming back next week? Because I felt betrayed. And at times I felt very disgusted, like literally disgusted by the ways the women were being treated. And I was going, who? I looked at my mother because I watched it live with my mom. And I was like, you do know that like there were at least three other people that saw this. There were like three chains of command that get these episodes.
Yeah.
And she was like, three? And I'm like, at least. These things go through drafts. You know, they go to a pitch table. Somebody writes them. EPs look at them, review them. They get drafted again. They go to the network. I mean, it's just a cyclical thing. And I thought, over the summer, I said that this show was one of the top five shows writing women well. At the end of this, I was like, this show doesn't know how to write women at all.
Yeah.
And that's a weird place to, that's a really weird place to be like, this show is so far ahead of the game, to being like, this show, like Twisted, is literally emotionally, like, I don't want to, this is icky. I think I labeled it after I finished it the worst episode of Sleepy Hollow that there has been. The worst, hands down, without question.
I would definitely agree, and I'm sure we're going to get on to Abby, but I just want to talk about what they did to Katrina this episode, who we've made no secret of saying is not our favourite character, but the trope of using female characters solely for their wombs, like the women being used as baby carriers trope has been done and done, especially in Supernatural, as carrying like demon babies and whatever, it has been done to death. And it reducing the woman's purpose to one of her organs is just horrible, disgusting. You used the word disgusting, and I think during what you were saying earlier, and yeah, I totally agree. I just have written in big bold letters and like outlined, angry, just angry.
I'll talk about this with Abby because this will come up too. Because this really, I like women with agency, and I like people to understand what agency actually means. I think sometimes we get tricked into believing that there are female characters who have agency who don't actually have agency because they have powers and they did this thing and they said no once, and that means agency. And I thought that with season two, Katrina would be getting a plot line, but she's still at the mercy of men.
Yeah.
Everything about her is still about the men in her life. That is not agency. She is a plot device still. She's just a plot device with more screen time now.
Yeah.
And I think, I know the baby carrier thing really upset you, but this is what really upset me. Like I said, I'm into horror movie stuff, and in my review, I wrote about the connection that I think the show is making between, it feels like they're doing, especially after 208 and the way 208 ends, that they're doing a Rosemary's Baby plot line. The problem with this is that, And I said this in my review, that the horror of Rosemary's Baby, it's not a very scary movie, actually. There's not a lot of scary parts. It's a psychological horror film. It's that at the end, this woman who understands the difference between right and wrong, who has literally fought to have her body back from being occupied by an evil force, right? At the end, she sees this child and she still loves it. She knows that it's going to bring the end of the world, but that a mother's love is so strong that she will topple nations, that she will bring about the death of millions because she loves it. Like, I don't even want to call it a baby. I just want to call it. It's an evil thing. right?
Yeah.
And we're watching Katrina do this. And the part that really upsets me about Katrina specifically is that it's mirroring abusive behavior, like a woman in an abusive relationship. The amount of pain that Henry has inflicted on his mother in the name of being evil, and to hear her sit back and go, but I still love him, there's still good in him, is terrifying. Yeah. I want you to understand that that is terrifying. That is literally like the epitome of someone in an abusive relationship. I can fix him. He isn't a monster. Yes, he is a monster. And we need to stop pretending like everything that he hasn't done to her isn't horrendous. Can we stop having the character who was literally almost ripped apart by her son after being indirectly invaded and assaulted by him? Can we please stop having a character her son is redeemable? Because he's not. If anybody ever does that to somebody that they care about, let me tell you something. Get them out of your life. That is not something that you keep around. That is not worth believing in anymore. If someone hurts you like that, let that shit go. You need to walk away, because there is nothing okay about that. You know, we have this whole concept of Jeremy / Henry is redeemable, and that Katrina would do anything for him, and that Crane should now dedicate his time to making his son good again. When Katrina didn't even think it was appropriate for Ichabod to go to England to bury Mary. Let's think about that. Katrina let a woman's body lay at the bottom of a cliff. She let a woman turn into a monster. Didn't even own up to it until it was forced into her face. But you know, that's because Crane had a job to do. But all of a sudden, because it's Henry, we can pause? We can hit the pause button? Like, I'm not actually understanding the logic of the way that they're developing Katrina. It's literally making no sense. And it's borderline, I'm not even gonna say borderline. There were times when I was watching this episode that I was like legitimately disturbed by what I was seeing. And I couldn't figure out if the show was trying to endorse this idea, this concept, or if they were trying to be like, no, this is bad. Do you see how bad it is? I think it's difficult to tell because the show keeps going over it. Oh, like, it's so repetitive. They're like, they just keep hitting that nail. They just keep hitting it over and over and over again. And so we're wondering if it's just an elongated version of the same plot line that could be handled in two episodes, or if it's the show trying to tell us, like, these are bad things. This is Crane's weaknesses, da-da-da. Like, you know, I mentioned before, does it feel like the second half of season one? Ichabod had some good development there. The problem came when it started happening in circles, when it got repetitive, when we didn't feel like it was going anywhere. And I sort of feel like that's what's happening with Katrina in particular and her relationship with Henry. She is simply saying the same thing over and over again as things get worse and nothing's developing. And that's bad writing.
Yeah. And I don't think I can add anything to that except another the wasted potential of Katrina being this vessel, because we talked about what that could mean, and we thought she was going to be like one of the horsemen of the apocalypse, which would have been amazing. But no, it was so pedestrian. It meant an actual vessel. Like, she is no better than a petri dish to grow this baby thing.
You know, at this point, like, I know there were a lot of fans at the end of season one who were like, if Katrina doesn't end up evil, this is the most ridiculous shit that I've ever seen. And I was like, I don't know. I feel like she can be good. And in 208, you sort of see that she can be on Team Witness. But, like, after this episode, after 207, I was like, if she doesn't end up evil, then you're wasting my time. You're literally wasting my time. Like, because you're working so hard to make another character redeemable, and you're using it through totally destroying another one, right? That character that you're using is becoming unredeemable themselves. Like, it's getting harder and harder to argue for Katrina's choices. Because they don't make any logical sense. And they keep hurting people. Like, how are you supposed to be a hero? Like, you're not a hero. Team Witness is full of heroes. We don't have time for people to be flip-flopping back and forth. We don't have time for people to be making careless mistakes. And yet, that's what keeps happening. And it keeps happening, not just because of Katrina. I don't want to just put all this on Katrina. Because of Ichabod Crane, too. Like, the fact that the man cannot make a decision for himself. Oh, God. I'm going to start going into Abby now. Well, I mean, just the fact that he can't make a decision for himself, that other people have to influence his choices. And they influence them so greatly. Like, he's a grown man. He fought, he led armies. He was the first witness. He took the head of the Headless Horseman off. How are you sitting here and telling me that this man cannot make important decisions by himself? It makes no sense. This makes no sense. Yellow. This is so depressing.
Yeah. Before we get into Abby, though, I do want to say one redeemable. Well, no, this episode was not redeemable. Let's stop throwing the word redeemable about. A positive I got from this episode was Reyes. I think her in this episode was really good. And I like her being back, and I like her. She was like a little tiny beacon of hope within this really dark, awful episode.
Yeah, I think I certainly felt the same way. I was so excited to have her back, yeah, and to sort of see her, you know, leading the team. I want her back, you know. I don't even know if at this point I don't feel like I'm getting Luke back. I don't feel like I'm getting Andy back.
Oh.
Jenny is here, so you have to insert her. Frank is here, so you have to insert her. I just want this to not revolve around the Crane family and their inability to make solid life decisions. You know? I mean, this is about saving the world, you know? And I don't feel like this is about saving the world. I feel like this is a lot of relationship drama that belongs on Days of Our Lives.
Yeah.
You know, I was talking to someone. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
It's become less about the sort of, I feel everyone is losing sight of the big picture here and is focusing more on the sort of small, really petty things.
Yes.
But this is the end of the world. Surely that takes priority over absolutely everything. Rather than bitching at your wife because you think she might have slept with the Headless Horseman.
Oh my God, girl. And he found out and he didn't even apologize.
No.
He found out what really happened and didn't even bother to apologize. This is what I'm talking about. Like, there are characters that are being villainized because of poor writing. Because of poor writing. Like, there are things that I feel like Katrina should be blamed for. Then there are things that I'm looking at this going, you're just villainizing a character. I mean, you're literally just villainizing a character. And if you're going to do that, that's fine. But make them a villain. Stop telling me that they're a hero. Stop. I'm tired of it. I'm so tired. I was just thinking about, you know, I think that one of the things that season one did really well was taking these metaphors and these themes and the relationships and linking them all together. Right, so you have these big moments. This is where these epic moments happen, where you just sort of get the feels all over the place. Because the character has sort of like unlocked something about themselves and their duty through a theme or a development in a relationship, which relates back to that personal theme. And one of the things that I think
is wrong in terms of people always talking about the Crane family drama. And some people get offended by that, but I think you need to listen to exactly what those people are saying when they say Crane family drama. Look at the way Frank is written. Frank has family drama. But Frank's family drama, for example, when Frank has a problem with his wife, he doesn't sit in front of Abby and have that conversation. It's not on public display. There's a level of respect that is given to the characters. They are not for they're not written. Their relationship isn't for the entertainment of other people. It's not a punchline. It's not a way to dramatically up the stakes with no regard to who they are as people. I feel like the Crane family drama is overly dramatic. It isn't. It's hard to feel for people involved in it in a way that it is very easy to feel for Abby and Jenny, or it is easy to feel for Frank and Macy and Cynthia. And it's the writers. I think it's the writer's fault. That's where the fault lies. It's how you're choosing to write them. I don't know why. I think that the Crane family could have these really meaningful moments. I think back to 109, and despite the fact that I did not like that Ichabod went back into that house, that connection that he has about learning that he has a son and who his identity is and his relationship to his father and what that means for him as a character is incredibly moving. You have this really soft moment where he just has this awakening and this realization of everything that he thought he wanted but couldn't have, he could have had. But at what cost? And, you know, does it mean he becomes his father? You know, what about him? Why do we even introduce Crane's father if we weren't going to talk about that relationship and how that impacts what he's doing with his son? You know, I feel like that is good drama. That is something that I want to see on screen. I don't want to see Ichabod call his wife a slut.
Yeah.
No, that's not good. I don't care about that. And quite frankly, it makes Ichabod look terrible. Like, I don't know how everybody else felt about that scene, but I was like, did you really think your wife stepped out on you after everything? After everything. After everything you've dragged Abby through, by the way, too. Because she has to believe in Katrina. You know, being sent to purgatory and constantly having to back down from her ideals and what she believes to agree with you. Now you want to take shots at your wife? You know, I don't know. It just seems like such a mess all the time. And I don't know what to do or how to fix it because I sort of feel like they haven't learned. The writers. That's what it feels like. It just feels like a repeat, except worse.
I'm going to use a word, and I can use this word because I do put the explicit tag on this podcast. And this episode was just a big clusterfuck. It was just, there were so many things wrong with it that it was just unfathomable that, like you said, it's gone through minimum 3 tiers of okaying.
Guys, that's so horrible. It's horrible. There were all these people that looked at this and were like, yes, let's do it. And we're all looking at this going, what are you doing?
It was a case of, are you going to tell him or are we? No, just let's not tell. And then no, everyone thought someone else was going to tell them that, no. There are several things not okay with this. It was just like a communication breakdown.
Let's chalk it up to that, because that is where the faith issue lies. If an entire creative group put this episode through and thought that this was okay, and we haven't even touched on Abby yet, put this through and thought this was okay, then what does this say about the show going forward?
Yeah, I don't even want to think about that. So yeah, let's before we get too far down the rabbit hole, let's talk about this episode. Sparked off a hashtag. I don't know if you were living under a rock, but this thing took over Twitter, and it was Abby Mills deserves better. And all I have on the mat to say on the matter is, amen. But I feel you'll probably have slightly more to say on the matter.
Abby Mills is a lead. Abby Mills is not a sidekick. She is not here to emotionally support Katrina or help her have her babies. She is not here to sit there and make Crane feel better about the bad choices that he makes. Abby Mills is a witness. She is a hero. And her job is to protect the world. And what the show has ingrained in us is that it's so much a part of what she does that it harms the people that she cares about. So what I don't understand is why repeatedly, especially after what happened with Purgatory, Abby is still as a character allowing Crane to manipulate her like that. And I will say manipulate. When I was talking about agency and a character having agency, and allowing people to make us think a character has agency when they really don't. This is how I know Abby does not have agency in the show anymore. Because every time that Abby Mills has an idea or has a belief, and she makes it very clear to Crane that this is why she feels this way and this is why they shouldn't do something, Ichabod sets his piece, he gets her judgy eyes, and she backs down. Why are you having a character who so staunchly believes in something, who has such a strong backbone when it comes to anything else, who we will later see in the next episode argue with a woman, not argue with a man? Why is Abby Mills handicapped by Ichabod Crane? Because it doesn't even feel like a partnership anymore. You mentioned this when we were speaking earlier about, you know, Abby perhaps enjoying the attentions of another man because she's feeling neglected. And while I said, oh, wow, that seems like something the writers would do, I also said, oh, wow, that's really gross. And I said that it's really gross because of the idea that a woman needs a man to feel whole. They tell me that Abby and Crane aren't romantically linked, and yet everything about the relationship and the way they develop Abby in relation, or almost everything, in relation to Crane, makes me think that they are. It literally makes me feel like sometimes, like she's a side chick. That she is another romantic interest. They write her that way, in relation to him, and I do not understand why. Why is this character who could not have Crane convince her to leave Purgatory, who told him that she had to stay because she had to sacrifice just like he did, which I would argue he did not sacrifice in the same way that she did in 106, but whatever, they made the parallel. We'll leave it at that. Why is this woman all of a sudden now saying, I have this feeling, but Crane, you're getting a little heated, so I guess I'll go along with you.
And we have mentioned, we've mentioned how important and how integral it looks like they're making her faith in things. But if it just takes Crane a look to put the little woman in her place, how disgusting that sentence feels coming out of my mouth. But, you know, she's not going to be able to develop. And if they're trying to push that storyline that she has this faith, you know, she doesn't have, they're making it out that she doesn't have her own, like, they don't have their own opinions without the other one. So how is she going to use this faith if she needs to have his permission to do these things? What are they doing?
You mentioned faith, and this is where I think, like I mentioned with Ichabod's blind faith, I think this is where faith is a hindrance.
Yeah.
is a hindrance to Abby. This is not the kind of relationship that I signed up for. If you don't want a romantic relationship between Abby and Crane, that's fine. But this is not what a platonic familial relationship looks like. This is not. August Corbin would not have treated Abby like this. From what we saw, August Corbin did not treat Abby like this. So why is it suddenly okay for Ichabod to? Why does Ichabod get away with everything in the entire world? I would like to talk about that idea, that Katrina gets called a slut and Abby can't stand by her beliefs when it comes to Crane. But Ichabod gets to run around and he gets to make poor decisions and he gets to leave his partners behind in purgatory and he gets to, you know, be wishy-washy about how he feels about his son and he gets to prioritize his son over the world. But God forbid the women do anything. God forbid the women have any sort of development. The idea that they were at one point the angel and devil on his shoulder, that they are like the visual metaphor of his subconscious. Like, what are we doing? What are we doing? There is no triangle here. Again, with the triangles, I do not understand this. The idea that we can't have Abby argue with Crane, but Abby will argue with Katrina. Let's think about this. How many times has Katrina actually been in a scene with Jenny?
Ooh.
How many times has Abby been in a scene with Katrina where she wasn't throwing shade or where she wasn't disagreeing with Katrina? Or 20 minutes later, she wasn't agreeing with Katrina? It would be one thing. It would be one thing if Abby was consistent. The way they were writing Abby was consistent. But it's not. It's not consistent. You know, the idea that she's sitting here saying your son is a monster, and rightfully so, and Katrina's in the corner like, no, boo, no, he's not. And Ichabod is allowing Katrina, who was a witch, who barely uses her powers, and who was not a witness, is allowing her opinion to trump Abby's? We need to talk about that. Because Katrina is not a lead. She is not witness two. I won't even say that. She's not witness one. Because Ichabod isn't witnessing right now. He's trying to take care of his family. So the idea that once we get Katrina here, that she's only a negative force, what is the point of having her here? Like, I'm literally looking at this and going, you're not writing Abby well. You don't know how to write women in scenes together. You don't know how to develop women in relation to men. Abby Mills is literally probably, if I had to pick, outside of Frank, who we barely even see now, Abby is the most consistent character on the show. In terms of the hero cycle and the hero trope. Except when it comes to Crane. And then Abby makes no sense. And I want to believe in the relationship and the type of adoration that they have for each other. Because I think it's beautiful and I think we need to see relationships like that on television. I think it is so important because as a girl who had very little male influence in her life. The men who were there were very good to me, and they were very good men. And they are my few examples of what a good man is. And I look at where they started and where Abby is now, and if I was a young girl and I was looking at the way Abby was being treated by Crane in relation to Katrina, honestly, I would say that it was a bad example. I wouldn't want my young self to see that. I wouldn't want my young self to see a very smart, capable, passionate fighter. Vulnerable fighter. Belittled and trumped by the opinion of a man she supposedly cares about. Abby Mills deserves better. Like, girls deserve better.
Yeah.
This is not how you write female leads. And like, I literally had it when Abby was helping Katrina have the baby. And I realized that the show, and I don't know if you made this connection, but I realized that the show was trying to parallel her and Grace.
Oh.
And I went, are you joking? That's like a literal sidelining. A literal sidelining of a lead character. It's not poetic. You know what would have been poetic? Abby climbing the window while Crane, who, after previously calling his wife a slut, holds his wife through her pregnancy. That he is there, that his hand is holding hers, and he is telling her that everything is going to be okay, that he is not going to leave her, that he believes in her. And that Abby is consistently doing what we have seen her do. The action. That, if you're looking for a meaningful Crane family moment, that was it. If you are looking for a moment where Abby connects with the two Cranes and this weird triangle that you have, that is it. But instead, Ichabod had to be the hero this time. Out of all the times that Ichabod could have been a hero, this was the time he had to do it. And this was the time that we had to make gross parallels between a hand servant and a second witness.
I know we talked at the, you know, whenever we were reviewing the series last year about how good this show was with its writing women, and its writing diversity, and it's just, it's inconceivable that this episode is coming from the same people who did that, those really good dynamics that we were praising.
Inconceivable. That is, you're like, your word choice is so on point.
Like, what the fuck are they doing?
That was literally why the hashtag got started, because that was everyone's response after the end of the episode. What the fuck are they doing? And that's when I literally went, I don't know if I trust this team anymore. I don't know if they got it right because they intentionally got it right the first time or because they got lucky. That makes me nervous.
Yeah.
You know, I know why I came to this show. And I can tell you right now, it wasn't because it was Ichabod Crane coming back from the past. Because that made me not want to watch the show. I remember when the show got picked up and I was like, this is the most ridiculous shit I've ever heard. Who the fuck is watching that? Right? And here I am. I can tell you what brought me to the show. And it's none of what they're paying attention to right now. It's none of what they're doing right.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I know Orlando commented about it. I had somebody tweet me his tweets. I wasn't following it. I was following the hashtag. I wasn't following the news around the hashtag. And you know, he told fans to stick it out, and there's more to come. But this isn't just about representation, guys, because we wouldn't be having this issue if the writing was good. This is about good storytelling. And because the storytelling is not good, everything else is falling apart. The choices that they are making are just not smart. And I feel like the first three episodes were written to literally placate the issues that we had with the first season. I feel like the changes are being made, but they're not being taken seriously. What people are saying. It's like, oh yeah, we'll write this thing, but then we'll let it go. Because we just want you to not be upset. So we'll give you this thing, and then we'll carry on our way, on our merry way, and keep doing what we were doing. And that upsets me. You know, as someone who loves stories, as someone who loves the excitement, there are parts, and we'll talk about, you know, 208, there are parts of 208 that I was like, this is the magic, man. Like, this is it. This is what it's about, you know? And I don't understand the first three episodes were so, the writing was so consistent. The writers changed from episode to episode, but the consistency and the plot development was so strong. And I look at this and I go, oh yeah, these were all written by different people. These were all written by people who I feel like don't know the story or who these characters are. And while I could just be mad at the individual writers, they've got an entire exec team above them who do know who these characters are, who do know what this story is. This is their baby too. So why they would okay this, I mean, that's rubber stamping it. That's saying, yeah, this is canon. This is not like AU either. I think that's the really scary part, is that we can be like, oh, this is just AU. It's not real. But this is canon. This is what the show is taking seriously as part of its narrative. I don't know. I don't... It was a really upsetting episode. It was hard coming back for 208. And I never thought I would say that about Sleepy Hollow. But it was hard coming back.
Yeah. If episode 8 had been reminiscent of episode 7, I'm not sure I would have come back for episode... If I would be coming back for episode 9. Because if, you know... Although, having seen that it's about Jenny and Abby and their mother, that would have tempted me in. That I'm so, so interested to see how they handle that episode after this clusterfuck.
I'm scared.
Yeah.
I feel like I've seen some of the EPs and I've seen some of the writers be like, well, guys, next week it's about Abby and Jenny. And it's not, it feels like they're saying, but here's your Abby and Jenny. And you're still missing the point. Because if you're not telling the story right and you're not telling it in a fun and an interesting way, in a way that organically and respectfully develops these characters, then you're still not doing it right. Then an episode about Abby and Jenny means nothing. I mean, I've watched other shows do this where they're like, oh, hey, but there's this episode. And then they totally mess the episode up. And it just makes people more angry and it makes them feel more disconnected from the narrative and have less faith in what the story that's being told. I'm scared. I am excited, but I'm also scared. And to speak on this, when I was watching the end of 208, I watched this one too with my mom, and she was lying on the couch next to me, and she like sort of twisted her head and looked up at me upside down, and she saw the promo, and she was like, are they trying to make Abby and Jenny's mom an evil ghost? And she was like, that sounds so ridiculous. And this is a woman who is like fiercely fought in Sleepy Hollow's name, in defense of Sleepy Hollow. And not to mention about a show, she's saying this about a show that is already itself within its nature ridiculous.
Yeah.
So if she's going, well, that sounds ridiculous, I'm sitting here going, well, what the hell is everybody else thinking? Because, I mean, we'll sit here and have this conversation, but we're dedicated fans. But what about the general audience? You know? When they watch this, are they going, this is insane. Or this is boring. You know? And not... It's sad. It's sad that it's going this way, and it's sad that I was really eager for Mama, and I'm nervous about it now. It's sad that the ratings are reflecting the negative opinion of many of the viewers, because it's reflected in the ratings. And here's the thing that I really want the writers to understand, as they've already written further, you know, further into the season, the other episodes. You can't fix things with a single episode. You can't be like, well, I'm going to give you this and then continue on the road that you're on. You have to change the road. And if you don't do that, ratings will continue to fall. You know, as a ratings person, I don't know if you noticed this, but Sleepy Hollow scored, I think this episode scored a 1.5 in the 18 to 49 demo, which was a series low.
Ugh.
And it scored this when I believe Gotham got like a 2.6.
Wow.
I want people to understand the dynamics of this. This is why this is like absolutely upsetting. Because when you have a lead-in, lead-ins are supposed to help bump your first half hour rating. So Nielsen does half hour ratings, so the first half hour, second half hour. And the rating that we get, the 1.5, is the average between them. The presumption, two things could have happened. There could have been two scenarios. One, everybody who's watching Gotham clicked over onto a different station 2 minutes before 9 o'clock rolled around, which meant that they would not have gotten clocked in for Sleepy Hollow. Or they were all still there at the start of Sleepy Hollow, and halfway through the episode, they got tired and they left. And so many of them left that the average, the second half hour dropped so tremendously that the average ended up being at 1.5.
Yeah.
Either way, people ain't watching your show. And there's a very, I feel like there's a specific, there's like, they had ratings issues last season. And part of it, I feel like, had to do with the same issues that they're facing now. And we are only 7 episodes in. We have
11.
We have, oh my God. We have 11 left of season 2.
I don't
want to imagine where that the ratings thing could go. I don't want to imagine that.
I think they need, hopefully the Abby Mills deserves better hashtag thing, because it was quite a sight to behold. Hopefully that's
so proud of everybody.
Yeah, I hope that was a slap in the face and a shoulder shake to the writers to be like, look, if you don't clean up your act, then you're not gonna have an act. I think that's the realistic.
It is, exactly. You know, and it's not just about having more Abby centric episodes. It's about how you're writing your characters. It's about how you're using your ensemble. It's about whether you're choosing, who you're choosing to villainize. How you're choosing to villainize them. Or does your story feel like filler? Or does it feel like it's continuing with the plot that you have established? You know, the writing game has got to change. They got to get better at it. You know, Abby Mills deserves better. So do your viewers. Every single one of them.
I think that just sums up episode 7. I don't even really want to talk about the plot, like the Hellfire Club and the stupid 666 pin code.
It was hard to laugh at the jokes.
Yeah, because you were just so drained by the shitty things that were going on to Abby.
I couldn't believe it. Like I said, I got 30 minutes into that screener, and I was like, I literally posted on my Tumblr, like, if this is how I feel, I can only imagine how everyone else is going to feel. You know?
Yeah, this...
Women deserve better.
This is... deserve better. As fans, as, you know, fans dedicated enough to sit through half an hour of Skype throwing a shit fit to talk about this stuff. What is the casual viewer? The casual viewer won't care anymore. They're not invested enough to sit through this crap. Whereas...
Right. And you're testing my investment?
Yeah! If you're testing the people that really, really care, you've just lost all your... people who are sitting on the fence. You've lost them. You've completely lost them.
Oh. Yeah. It was a sad episode indeed. It was, but I'm glad. I'm really glad. Social media can be a really great thing. Like I know people consider it a nuisance, but to be able to not like feel alone and like, wow, that was a shitstorm. You know, like, to be like, okay, we need to let them know this has to change. Because the thing that we love won't be here next year if it doesn't. You know, and as someone who has actively told people to not worry about the ratings so much, I am now telling you worry about them. Because if this is where we are at episode 7, and we have 11 more weeks to go with a hiatus and spring numbers, which are almost always lower than fall numbers, I don't know if the following got renewed because Kevin Bacon was a lead with a 1.4 in its finale. I don't know with Sleepy Hollow's budget if that's even justified.
Yeah.
And
if 7 episodes in, we're already talking about maybe not getting a third series, the show is not looking good.
Oh. Oh my God. I just want everybody back. Just bring them up. Oh my God. This is so upsetting.
It is.
This is really upsetting.
I think that's...
This is a really traumatic episode.
It is. So I think we have pretty much talked about everything we wanted to talk about, or ranted about everything we wanted to rant about at this point. I think... Yeah, I think now would be a nice time to just sort of step away from the microphone. So we will be back to review episode 8 later in the week. At the start of the episode, I forgot to give you the contact information, but I shall do that now. If you do want to get in contact, and if perhaps you feel differently about, perhaps you disagree with our endless ranting, if so, we'd love to hear a different opinion, because I think we both still quite strongly that this was not a good episode. But if you, or if you agree, please help validate our opinions.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And you can,
conversation is good.
Yeah. And you can do that at welcometosleepyhollow@gmail.com. You can contact us at Twitter. Our handle for Twitter is @WTSHpodcast. And our Tumblr is welcometosleepyhollow.tumblr.com with the number 2, not the word. All right. That was an interesting discussion. we will see you again sometime later in the week, probably quite close to episode 9. I think we're going to record on Saturday, which is the plan.
So yes.
Probably be out. I'll have it edited and out for Sunday. And we will see you again. But for now, bye.
Bye. 'Cause you had a bad day, you take it one down.